Hey everybody, thanks for checking out the podcast. This week my guest is a legendary comedian and actor who I've looked up to for a long time. I'll tell you about him in a minute, but my rant this week is I got in a big fight over a 45-cent red onion. I really have to reassess what I'm doing in my life. I had a hamburger, didn't have an onion. I like onion on my hamburger. I checked the refrigerator, nothing. I go across the street to this little market where I live here in New York. Get a red onion, put it on the counter, 45 cents for the onion. I give the woman a 20 and she goes, "I won't break that." Not, "I can't break it, I won't break it." I go, "Why not?" She goes, "It's too big a bill, you gotta buy more." I'm like, "I don't wanna buy more, I just want the onion." She goes, "No, you gotta buy more." I go, "No, that's not the deal. The deal is I come in a free society and you have stuff to sell and I decide what I wanna buy and I give you this $20 bill, which is a promissory note from the federal government that says, you know, present this and you will get paid, and I take the red onion and I don't put a bullet in your head today." And she's like, "Well, I'm not going to break it." And I go, "Well, I want a red onion." She goes, "Well, yeah, I'm not selling you the red onion." And then I blurt out in loud tone, "I have a right to a red onion." Now, at this point, I stepped out of myself and I'm hovering above the conversation, which I'm sure you've probably done at one point in your life, and I'm thinking, I hear myself say, "I have a right to a red onion," and I'm like, "I gotta move to the woods. I gotta move to the woods. I can't be around people anymore. I don't need electricity or cable or anything. I just need a hut, keep me dry, and I'll eat berries and drink my own urine to survive. I don't need it. It's just not worth it," right? So she goes, "Well, I'm not selling you the red onion." So I go, "Okay." So I go, "Well, I want to talk to the manager," because I'm that guy. I always have to speak to the manager, right? So she sends me to this kid who's like a 21-year-old kid with his hat, a baseball cap on backwards, moving lemons around. And I'm like, there's no way this guy's a manager, because managers don't rearrange lemons. That's a low-level, entry-level position responsibility. Managers are not redistributing fruit at this stage of their career. So I go, "Look, I want this onion." She won't change. She goes, "Oh, I'm sorry. We don't have any change." I go, "How do you not have change? You're a store with items and a sign and a door you open and a little bell rings, ding-a-ling-a. Well, what are you running, a children's lemonade stand?" So he goes, "I'll tell you what." He goes, "Take that red onion, come back tomorrow and pay for it." I'm like, no. I want to think I've accomplished something in my life. I don't want on my list of things to do on Wednesday, pay for red onion. I have shit to do. I'm important, okay? So I take the red onion with no intention of paying for it. And I cut it up. I put it on the hamburger. I'm pissed now. The hamburger's cold. I don't even really want to eat it. I go back to the refrigerator to get something to drink. I look in one more bin. I had a red onion. All right, so that was that. So if you see me, you know, on CNN as having shot a bunch of people, you'll know why. Because somebody wouldn't let me buy a red onion without giving me aggravation. All right, this week my guest is Larry Miller. Brilliant comedian. You've seen him in Pretty Woman, Princess Bride, Jerry Seinfeld's sitcom Seinfeld, Curb Your Enthusiasm. He's been in over 100 films and television shows, and a brilliant comedian. You've seen him on Letterman, you've seen him on The Tonight Show. And Larry started out in New York City with Jerry Seinfeld and Paul Reiser, and has great stories about starting out in New York City as a comic. He and Jerry and Paul are still good friends to this day. How they helped each other with their acts. How he was a horrible bartender. He's got a hilarious story about that. This is somebody that you've seen a lot in film and television, and has a really interesting story about how he got into comedy and what it was like being a new generation of legendary comics. Like, they established a new kind of comedy after George Carlin and Richard Pryor. He and Jerry and Paul and some others. George Wallace is another guy from that era. So somebody that you've known and enjoyed for a long time, and you're going to get to know really well, sort of behind the scenes, so to speak, in this podcast. So thanks for checking it out. If you want to keep building the podcast, please send the link around and ask your friends to subscribe. You can go to iTunes and follow me on Facebook and Twitter. And coming up, tour dates for me, May 1st and 2nd, I'm going to be in Providence, Rhode Island at the Comedy Connection. And May 7th through the 10th, I'm going to be at the Funny Bone in Cincinnati. It's also technically in Kentucky, but the Funny Bone in Cincinnati. May 7th through the 10th, and May 15th and 16th in Long Island at the Brokerage Comedy Club in Belmore. All right, enjoy the podcast, people. Welcome to the podcast this week, everybody. I am joined, I'm here in Los Angeles at the Adam Carolla Studios, by a comedian that I've admired for a long, long time. I saw you in New York when I wasn't even a comic yet, and you're one of the comics that established a kind of comedy for its own generation, Larry Miller. And amazing to have you on the show.
Boy, that's pretty amazing to hear that introduction, too. Thank you.
Well, I will tell you, for people who don't know, you have Mort Saul that leads you to Lenny Bruce, that leads you to George Carlin and Richard Pryor, and then and somewhere mixed in there is Robert Klein, and then it's you and Jerry Seinfeld and Paul Reiser and those guys that created that smart, clean, storytelling, observational brand of comedy that sort of then launched thousands of comedians from that. And you guys were at the epicenter, and the first club that I passed at in New York City was the Comic Strip.
Oh, boy, how do you like that? See, people should know that the when we all started, there was clubs like Catch a Rising Star.
On First Avenue, right?
Right.
In 70-something Street.
Yeah, and 77th. Mm-hmm. And then the Improv on the West Side, which was
44th and 9th, Bud Friedman, right. and Silver Friedman.
That's right. I realized, boy, he knows all of them. And I go, of course you do. You work there. But, yeah, it was those were great places. And then when I had graduated from college and I was thinking, well, I want to be in show business. I know I'm going to be in show business.
You majored in music at Amherst.
Right.
Right? Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I got a job at Amtrak, and which was terrific. I'll tell you.
Is that show business by definition?
Well, it is to me. You know what? But I knew that as I worked there, I wanted to get in, I wanted to start in show business, and one of the women I worked with there at Amtrak said to me, you know, there's a new comedy club that just opened, and her uncle worked there, Tony D'Andrea, who's just great, and he and I became friends, and she said, you should go up there and take a look
at
it.
I met Tony at some of the comic strip Christmas parties years ago. Yeah.
I still love the guy, and I just, what a talented guy. Hmm. And that's on 2nd Avenue. Between 81st
and 82nd, yeah, still there. Richie Tinkin owns it.
That's right. Well, Richie Tinkin, who, by the way, was Eddie Murphy's manager.
Right.
And those guys really soared up there.
Yeah.
It was interesting, too. It was because of Tony. That's right. When Tony was working, these guys were bar owners and club owners,
yep.
Richie and John,
mm-hmm.
and John McGowan, and they were good friends with Tony. And Tony said, I'm going on to Catch a Rising Star tonight. It was a Monday night. It was an audition night. And he said, why don't you come down? I want you to be there and see me. So they went down like friends.
Yeah.
And everybody gets 5 minutes, and Tony wasn't going on, and they were there at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. And
the place is packed.
Jammed, yeah. And Tony went over to, Richie and John went over to Tony and said, what are we doing here? What's going on? And Tony went over to Rick Newman, and said, say, I got some friends here, and they want to see me work. Can you tell me when I'll be going up?
And Rick Newman's the owner of Catch a Rising Star.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Rick says to Tony, look, you know what? Customers I don't need. But what I need is, and they start to say something else, but just Richie and John heard him say, customers I don't need. And their
bell goes off.
That's right. The little light bulb goes on over the head. And they said, well, holy mackerel, this sounds like a business we should get into.
Right.
And that's exactly what they did. They built their own club a couple blocks away.
Mm.
And that's all they had to hear was, customers I don't need.
Right. And because Richie had 6 different clubs. He's a dropped out of high school, tough kid from the Bronx, a street kid. He would dress in all black because it fit into all the, he had different kinds of clubs. Like he had like an Irish bar, then he'd have like a disco. And he said, so that way I could go around to each club at night and look like I belong, right? And I didn't know those details about the catch, but he said it just seemed like a business to get in. And by the way, just I wanted to mention as well, a great actor, not just a great stand-up. 5 Levels of Drinking, one of the most brilliant comedy bits ever.
Thank you.
And if you don't know it out there, go Google it. And a great actor, Pretty Woman, Seinfeld, Just Shoot Me, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Monk, A Mighty Wind, hilarious movie, Nutty Professor movies. And by the way, your character in Seinfeld, the passive-aggressive doorman, it is so, so funny. And, like, it's I saw it a week ago. And just tearing everything
That's good brilliant. To know, too. And you know what? I learned a great acting lesson on that show, in fact. Mm. You can learn great acting lessons all the time, folks, if you're in a movie or a TV show. And some of the advice that I heard from Milton Berle about Spencer Tracy, if you want to see how far back I can go, but before anyone was born.
Well, Moses told me.
No. That's right. Exactly right. That he said, look, my brother's a real pain. But, you know, but Spencer Tracy's advice in acting was just say the words and don't bump into the furniture.
Right.
And it sounds silly maybe, but it's really deeply true. Mm. Berle told me that, and he said he mimed. He was a great impressionist, Milton Berle. And he showed me, we're in a this sounds like I'm making this up, but we were in a coffee shop with his wife in the middle of the night in Las Vegas, and he said to me, he said, does this look familiar? Speaking of Spencer Tracy, and he like kind of rubbed his hand on his chin and his cheek, and he's looking down, and then he looks up at me and then says the line or something. And I said, well, that's exactly right. That's Spencer Tracy. And he said, well, you know why he looked down? He was looking for the mark,
really?
To hit.
Really?
So that's what he did. He was not lying. That's
He was literally trying to not
just say
be in the
words
wrong spot.
And don't bump into the furniture.
Wow.
And God knows he was one of the greatest actors ever, Tracy. But it's wonderful to hear wisdom like that. I learned so much at the comic strip and those places.
I want to go back to the comic strip in a minute, but I'm curious. How much of that character on Seinfeld is the doorman? Was you interpreting the character in a way that gave it that, or was it written exactly that way? Because it's so funny and brilliant. The dialogue is so crisp, and you're so good. You turn everything around on Jerry. You can't get a word in edgewise.
Thanks.
Did you bring some of your own take to that? Or
No. Hmm. One of the things that was so great about Seinfeld, if everyone remembers or still watches it, they really, Jerry and Larry David, and of course, you know, the staff of writers, but it was Jerry and Larry David really wrote every word on that show. Mm. And those are two funny guys.
Yeah.
So the point is, in fact, and he's been a close friend. And after the first day or two of rehearsals there on set to do that part, because I was spinning, throwing stars. I was doing everything to squeeze a drop out of it.
Yeah.
And that's fine, but it's not fine. Mm. He said, you know what? He said his variation of just say the words and don't bump into the furniture.
This is Jerry talking to you. Yeah. And you guys are very close friends,
very
by
close.
The way.
And you know what? I looked at him for a second. I said, you know, maybe you're right. And that let the personality come out of me, of the character. You stand there, and you can now just be funny with funny stuff. They're giving you a great pool cue. Just swing.
Yeah, you're so great in that role. And do I have this correct that you were up for for George Costanza as well? You had read for it?
Right. But you know what? The truth is, number one, we couldn't be closer friends. And the truth is that they couldn't have cast that show even an inch better. Mm. Good Lord. Mm. I mean, come on. Mm. Right, folks? I mean, come on.
I tell people, if you want to learn about acting, writing for television, watch the early episodes of a series and then watch it in the middle and watch it at the end. And how the rhythms change and the writing is tighter. They didn't have an initial chemistry that much, but it came together.
Sure.
They were all in. Michael Richards was not that. Just an entrance. He milked every moment that he could as the show went on. But initially, he was very much on the page, on the line.
Sure.
And he sprinkled some water on a flower, and that flower was him, and it bloomed, and they all did. And I watch it with my son now. It completely holds up.
It's going to be a great show for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
By the way, Michael Richards was told by one of the directors in the early days, I don't want to say who it was because I don't want to embarrass someone, But the director said to him, "You know what? Let's can that walking in the door like that. You know, let's just come on and just make the entrance and do the lines and just." And Richard kind of looked at him and said, "I think that's the funny part coming in, you know,
right.
And doing that half slide, a little jerk of the head and shoulders, and it is, it's hysterical."
Oh, God.
And so, a couple of things happened quickly because he took it out. And then Jerry and Larry said to him, "Why did you take out the coming in the door, the funny part?" And he said, "Well, so-and-so told me to take it out." And Michael Richards immediately, with their instructions, went back to doing it the way that was funny.
It made it
and that director was not seen on that set for a while.
Oh,
well, that's all right. You make your judgments in show business. But, folks, you know what? Sometimes you just have to... Especially if you're coming on the set as a director on a TV show, go with what they have. I learned that. Seinfeld said, you know, just trust the material. And then everything you have in you will just come out.
Right.
And he was right.
Yeah. Well, the comic strip is still there. Richie is still there. There's in one part of the bar area, there's a big frame with pictures just kind of stuck in the frame of all of you guys. You've got big, thick, curly hair. You're a Jewish kid from Long Island.
Yeah.
And Joey Vega. Do you remember Stu Trivax?
Sure.
These are all – Stu Trivax and I used to write together. He's not doing stand-up anymore. Angel Salazar.
Mm-hmm.
Right? These are all guys that were probably like starting out when you guys were the main acts.
They were a couple of years younger, but – But that was what we called the showcase clubs at the time.
Yeah.
We had our class, so to speak,
was
me and Jerry and Reiser and Jimmy Brogan and Mark Schiff and Carol Leifer, and that was our little group there.
Yeah, and you – I read somewhere that you said for the first few years, like, you and Jerry would just walk around the city and observe and make each other laugh. And
we laughed so much, and – that's not lip service. I'm saying we would have waitresses at night come up to us who were great. We all got along so great. And they'd say, "I saw you two today on Lexington Avenue at about 68th Street." Because we would walk all around and she would say, "You know what? It's the same as always. One of you was on the sidewalk slapping the sidewalk laughing.
And the other one was bent over
the mailbox laughing."
That's great.
All we did, folks, it was – what a blessing. What a treasure trove that was. You have Central Park and all of Manhattan.
Right. A Korean deli, a hardware store, whatever
everything.
It might be. A hot dog stand, yeah.
Yeah, and I played drums at the comic strip too, and then for a while we decided I would give Jerry piano lessons at the comic strip because it was empty during the day.
Yeah.
And I bartended there a few days a week.
Oh.
But empty.
Yeah.
There was one or two guys who were big drinkers, but
were you commuting in from Long Island from your parents' house?
No, this was I lived on the West Side at 78th in Amsterdam. Funny, it takes me.
I lived at 78th in Columbus.
Really,
so I lived on 79th between Columbus and Amsterdam in my previous life before I quit my other job and became a comedian. I was a lawyer and an investment banker and owned an apartment on 79th between Columbus and Amsterdam, and then I wrote some jokes. And I saw Jay Leno at a private function, and I said, "I don't know if you need jokes, but you can have these. I don't know what I'm going to do with them." And he called me the next day, and he hired me to start writing jokes for the Tonight Show monologue.
That's great.
And then he did one of my jokes the following week on the Tonight Show, paid me $50 for this joke, and it blew my head off my shoulders. Now, for a middle-class kid from Rhode Island who was working on these big corporate merger deals, you'd think this $50 joke would be inconsequential, and it changed my life. And at the time when all this was happening, I had this apartment on the Upper West Side right around the corner from your place.
How do you like that? By the way, that money at those clubs, they never used to pay anything, not a dime.
So what was your – how did you eat? What was your – you just
– Well, they gave you food for free and T-shirts for free. And that's how we used to say – that's how you know your status – in some of these clubs, how embarrassed you have to feel walking past the owner with a steak. and that was still just lovable. I remember Lucian was passed on since.
Yeah, and Lucian Hold was, just to describe to people, he he started, I think, as a carpenter there and then yeah. Merged his way up to manager and then booker and had a very sort of erudite way about him, and he was well-read, mm-hmm. and he let you know that, and he was very opinionated and very honest with his opinions and critiquing your act, almost to the point of, you know, there was no frills. It was just right at you. And,
almost.
Yeah. It was 100%. You're right. Yeah.
There were concentration camp guards who had more subtlety. By the way, I'm saying that to make him laugh, too, because he was a great guy. We all got along well. And his family, I used to say, his mom, God bless her, and his sister, and he had a look that always looked to me like they're wonderful people.
Yeah.
But if you were in a wagon train around 1840 and you wanted to make sure you before you set off from the next stop, wherever it was, and you walked over and tapped the shoulder of the guy driving the wagon train in front of you, when he turned around and looked at you, that's the expression that whole family had. And if you know what I mean, it was kind of like a bank of rocks, just holy mackerel.
I know. Eyes were piercing. It was like they went right to your soul.
Oh, yeah. And everything, the kind of cheekbones. If you've ever wondered, folks, gee, white people don't seem that tough anymore. How could white people conquer everything? That's how. If you look like that, once a year, Lucian's mom would invite us all up there, and we went. She had a house north of New York City, but again, I just loved her and Lucian. But it's funny you say that. You can after talking to them, you walk back over to one of the comics and saw how she's doing. Tough woman. Tough woman. And I mean that as a compliment.
Yes, there's my wife is a WASP, I can say this, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and there's a hardness about some of those people. There's like the old Yankees, you know
some.
What I mean?
Again, I mean, how do you think the world moves this way?
You're right.
Gee, this is funny. In 1500, it was like this, and then suddenly, a couple of hundred years later, it's all English.
Right. Exactly.
Now, how do you figure that out? I don't know, but I knew by just tapping that guy on the shoulder on the wagon
That's
train.
That's a personality that takes over things.
Holy mackerel. Personality, this is a guy who's not afraid. Oh, there's a rock blocking us. They would get off and just go, just eat through it, you know. They didn't know what the word stop meant.
Oh, my God. I've never heard him described that way, and it's completely accurate.
Sure. It's a compliment.
I loved him. He was a great guy.
No, but I just mean as a group of people, that's how, wow. And then they just got the hole and beat the French and did this and did that. How do you do that? That's how.
That's how. He's like, this land, I want it. How? Because I want it. Boom, and you go in.
No, forgive me. Even the answer doesn't fit. I want this land. Oh, yeah, how? There's no answer to that. There's no explanation.
That's true.
There's nothing that really, oh, now I see. He goes up to that guy like the rock and goes, and just eats the guy.
That's how the Grand Canyon was made.
That's right.
Lucian Holt's family.
That's right. It was one rock blocking them, and they ate the Grand Canyon. But I'll tell you, I think it always made me laugh. That's how Lucian, well, God bless him. He's passed on now. But
was he the one that passed you at the club, or was that before? He was later, and someone else passed you, like Richie or somebody.
It was Richie or John or the both of them, and it was great. I didn't remember exactly. I don't quite remember even now, because none of this mattered to me when people used to ask in interviews or, well, what's it like going up every night? And we went up every night. Mm. I mean, 7 nights a week forever.
Yeah.
There was no – there was nothing
– some nights, maybe two shows a night, right?
Or more.
Yeah.
When you really got to where, well, you were the bee's knees, you would get to – you could go on at the – on a Saturday. We called this doing a Brogan, because Brogan did it all the time. He could do two shows in the three clubs, two shows at the Comic Strip, two shows at Catch a Rising Star, and two shows at the Improv, and arrange them in schedules. So, well, you took a bunch of cabs, but you could do it. I did it twice, and that was more than enough for
it's
me.
It's a lot.
Yeah, that was – I mean, okay, you can say you did it, but I just loved every night. you got on every night too. Yeah. And
were you helping each other with the material? Would Jerry watch you and Paul and vice versa and say, you know, try this? Or you go up and say, look, I'm stuck on this. Can you watch me do this?
Absolutely.
Help?
Yeah. I was a bartender there at night twice because, which was a good move. They like me and I like them, but I can't make drinks. And
which is probably something you should know how to do if you're going to be a bartender.
Probably. But I'm telling you,
you can't remember what goes in what or the amount of
the knew.
I never
was a bartender.
They have books. You can open the bartender's book in like a Manhattan.
Books.
And then,
yes. I was writing jokes. You know what, though? I never knew when a waitress would come. Two nights I was there. And then one of the waitresses would come to the side and say, okay, two Brandy Alexanders and three Slow Gin Fizzes and five big times at the beach or something like that.
Right.
And I just I would bring her back seven bottles of Bud. And I'd put them on the tray. And she said, this happened a lot. They would always say, Larry, this isn't what they ordered. And they weren't mad. And they said, Larry, this isn't what they ordered. And I always said, tell them it's free. Always. And she looked at me and I said, they'll be thrilled. And you'll get a good tip. Which was true. Now, I didn't know this, but they would walk back then, put the beers down and say, oh, the bartender said it's free. Pardon me. I should have one now. The bartender said it's free. They were thrilled and they gave her a nice tip. Now, after they one night, that was the first night bartending, the second night, and these were tough guys, Richie and John.
Oh, yeah.
They were, you know, I loved them and
street
they loved
guys,
me.
They were street guys. They were tough guys.
Yeah. They weren't kidding around.
Yeah.
They were tougher than the guy on that stagecoach. But anyway, but great guys. And when John, I think it was John, that looked in the beer cooler after that first night and was a giant canoe out of it. You know, it was all gone. Beer was all gone. I mean, it was a giant group of nothing where there had been 1,000 bottles of beer. And these were very you know, these were bar owners.
Yeah.
You got to make money.
Yeah, and very street savvy. Like, they could tell in a second if someone was pulling something on them. In a second. Yeah.
On the first St. Patrick's Day, when I was a bartender during the day.
They had you bartending on St. Patrick's Day?
Well, sure, but here's the thing.
Wow.
We got along so well, they didn't fire me. They put me on days, which is just reservations, really. Well, the couple of guys who were drinking creme de menthe all day and reading Screw magazine. And I like them and they like me because I let them sit there quietly and they drink all day long. And at any rate, once on St. Patrick's Day, John came up to me the night before in the club during the show and just said, listen, tomorrow, keep the front door locked. Don't let anybody in. Don't sell anything. I don't want to do it. For someone to say, I don't want to do any business here, I said, John, it's St. Patrick's Day. It's going to be jammed in the whole street. Because when the police and the firemen with the parade ends, when the whole New York St. Patrick's Day parade ends, right. And they're already, God bless them, they're already a little looped.
Yeah, exactly.
Or more than a little. And so they'd come down Second Avenue, and you see, oh, the comic strip with a clown on the front. Let's go in there. And they all did, and the cops are and the firemen are all in uniform, and bum, 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 they're all banging the door. But the thing is, John was right, because they would have, you know, they got to put a show on that night.
Yeah.
They, instead of making X number of dollars, you know, give guys some
fun. They
would
have had no booze to sell at the for the show.
Well, or the place gets a little banged up.
Oh, yeah.
There was
Larry Miller can't make any drinks, so he just gives everybody free booze.
Well, not during the day. But you know what?
You have
they
your standards.
Had some guys who, sure. Even though I'm not a bartender, I was a bartender. But I loved putting my foot up on the speed rack with the New York Post and do the crossword puzzle just like that. It was just empty. Mm-hmm.
So what happened when all of those beers were missing that night? You said it was a canoe and empty.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, by the way, let me just tell you about this St. Patrick's Day. So I had a couple of my friends come in from college.
Right.
And they were, you know, junior bond traders. They were in the first couple of steps of, well, doing really well and making a zillion dollars. And so I invited, there were three or four guys who came by. And I gave them Irish whiskey all day. I think it was Murphy's. So it wasn't even a good – it wasn't even Jameson's. It wasn't even a good one. I said, hey, you want some of this? I said, sure. So I poured them shots all day. So they went through a couple of bottles, and I didn't charge them anything for it. I mean, they're my friends.
Exactly.
And so that night at the show, I went up to John. There was a little hallway there between the bar area and the show area.
Right.
And John's – I'm coming in. I just gotten off stage. And I'm coming in back to the bar area. John's coming in. And the two of us meet in that area, and he says, oh, great. Sounded good. Sounded like you had a good set there. And I said, yeah. And then I just remembered, and I said to him, oh, I have to tell you, a couple of my friends – you were right about St. Patrick's Day. I didn't let anybody in. And, you know, God only knows what would have happened to the place then. And, you know, he's nodding, and I just said, but a couple of my friends came by, three fellas, and they drank a bunch of Murphy's all day. So, you know what, I didn't charge them for it, so I'll get you a couple of bottles of Murphy's, and I'll put them back there. And, in fact, I'll get you through – it was probably two – I'll get you three bottles of Murphy's. And I didn't even notice. He was just looking at me. And 2 years later, we became friends also, and we'd go out and have a couple of drinks, and he would tell me about places he went to. And he said to me one night, a couple of years after that, because I wasn't a bartender for long there.
No, it doesn't sound like you would be.
No, exactly right. But he just said, yeah, you were always always good. You know, we always liked you. And he said, do you remember that time you told me about those bottles of Murphy's you just gave your friends?
Yeah.
He said, I was thinking at the time as you told me, and I said, I remember now, you were just looking at me in the strangest way. And he said, well, no one ever steals from me. And I didn't think of it that way. I wasn't stealing anything.
Right.
I didn't think of it that way.
Right.
I thought, it was my friends there. And I meant it. I would go out to a liquor store and get three bottles of Murphy's.
So he probably was perplexed as to whether or not he should punish you or
– Punish.
Or maybe that's a word that's a little light.
He said to me, you know, for a second I thought I was going to have to take you out to Jersey. He didn't live in New Jersey. And when he said that to me, I kind of smiled, and then I thought, wait a minute. And he wasn't kidding.
Yeah.
He was going to leave me in a swamp there.
Over two bottles of Murphy's.
Over anything.
Yes, that's true.
Because it's a tough business.
Yeah.
And
those guys,
you know, a bartender shouldn't steal from you. Yeah. I didn't think of it that way.
But he had to know you weren't, because you were such an innocent. You were saying, look, I'll just replace it.
He'd never felt the feeling he was feeling. He'd never felt... It was
a mix of rage and being perplexed at the same time, right? You had to be. You had to be, just like he couldn't figure out whether he should take you to Jersey.
Right.
Or let you go buy two bottles or three bottles of Murphy's.
Or just – there was only one thing. It's never mind the bottles of Murphy's at that point.
Yeah.
It was just – what? Well, I kind of like this guy, and his friends are doing good shows, but I think I have to kill him. So that was the puzzled look I noticed of him trying to think, what do I do now?
Oh, that's so funny.
And so it was a wonderful place to be.
Yeah.
One night, of the two nights I bartended there, which is only by the way, it's astonishing.
You're not exaggerating. It was literally two nights.
I was just about to say, first of all, I'm not exaggerating. Mm. It was two nights, and it was exactly two. And it's actually astonishing that they brought me back for a second night.
Yes, exactly.
I can't make drinks. I mean, technically, anyone listening.
Did you tell anybody, like, look, I don't know, even before you did the first night, like, I don't know how to make a drink? Like,
no.
Why did they pick you and not Jerry or Paul or somebody else? Or
you got me, because they were all the same way.
Right.
They made Brogan a bartender once during the day, and that's right. Lucian had said to him, Jimmy, go get some bananas for this or the daiquiris or something. And Jimmy Lloyd was behind the bar, and he looked at him and just said, well, what do you mean, now? This is a group of people who become comics.
Yes.
Who really aren't used to having someone say, go do this now.
And do it appropriately and accurately and well, right.
Or just now. And so the second night I was there bartending. Reiser came in, that's right, and just said, hey, and I was behind the bar, and there's a show on. And Reiser said, hey, I'm going to try a new bit out I just wrote. You want to come in and take a look at it and see what you think? I said, sure, great. So I did. I went in there with him, meaning I left the bar. Talk about other sins that get you taken right to New Jersey. I just said, yeah, neat, cool. And I went into the showroom with him, and he went on in about 5 or 10 minutes, but I was in there the whole time.
Right.
Then I saw a set, which is 20 minutes. I saw the bit, and then we walked back, you know, out because I had some good ideas for it. But John comes in
like
when he's
hour.
On stage, and I'm in the room. So John comes in, as he liked to do. Hey, he's the squire of the manor there. Mm. It's his bar.
Right.
And he comes in, and of course, he's a smart bar owner. He knows what's going on. So he just glances, sees the waitresses. Hello, girls. And then he just glances behind the bar, and there's no one there. No one behind the bar.
For about almost a half hour.
Yeah, but this is a beyond
like a
the word
yeah,
sin,
yeah.
It's just nuts.
Yeah.
It's like going up into the cabin on, you know, an ocean liner or a tugboat or anything and seeing no one in there and the wheel is just spinning. And so he just said, where's Larry? And they said, they were very nice. The witch just said, oh, Paul Reiser came in and said he wrote something new and wanted Larry to see it. So Larry just went in to see it. And now, John, there was another 3 seconds pause there. Again, a feeling he didn't understand. What? And he kind of jogged in there just as once again we were coming out. And I said, hey, John. Hey, Paul just wrote a new bit. It's good, too, but we're going to go over some of the parts of it. And the same thing, he looked at me and then looked at Paul, and we went back out to the bar, and he just stood there, same thing, trying to think, do I have to kill them both now? What's going to happen here now? We need comedians.
I'm going to wipe out the entire inventory of comedians.
But what else can I do? I'm the owner of the bar.
And no one's behind it.
Yes, exactly right. And the waitresses wouldn't go behind a bar.
No.
No one would do anything behind the bar because, once again, it's a, well, sanctum sanctorum.
Yeah, you can't.
And
oh, my God, that's so funny.
So I went behind the bar and started bringing out bottles of Budweiser again for the waitresses whose orders were backed up.
So nobody was getting their drinks.
Nobody was getting their drinks, but then they were happy because they found out they were free. That was when John had said to me, what are you doing here? What is this? What's going on here? And I told him, number one, well, I don't know how to make drinks. And I mean, I didn't know. True, everyone out there listening can do this, and I could do this. I could make a scotch and soda.
Yeah.
Or a gin and tonic.
Right.
But I wouldn't, the amounts wouldn't be consistent.
It would be right.
Okay. And I wouldn't know exactly what I was doing in what order. So they wouldn't be, you know, good drinks. They'd be good drinks for, say, sophomore year in college. Where you just say, holy mackerel, that's a strong drink.
You light a cigarette next to it, the drink catches fire.
And you catch fire.
Yeah, everybody in the room catches fire.
And the room, too. So I had a wonderful time there at the comic
strip. Now, what was, as you develop as a comic, we all develop our own persona. Was, let's say, Paul, Jerry, you, Brogan was brilliant with crowd work. I can remember seeing him talking to the crowd and just being so funny and quick, but did Jerry have a certain particular type of joke in helping you that he was good at versus Paul helping you with another kind of joke that he was particularly good at and you with them? Like, were you the guy or were you sort of all – I mean, you're all sort of similar in terms of observational storytellers, but
– it style didn't matter because we were good friends, very good friends. Mm. And so your thoughts could come out. And the guy you were giving them to could say, oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, good thought. That's a good thought. I could have the guy come out and say this or that.
He understands you so well as a person that he can help. He knows where you're going and where your mind's going with that.
And he can take what I gave him and say, yeah, I could use that in his way.
Right.
And it's just a wonderful way to be. Jerry and I had...
Okay, we are back. This is for my producer, Lydia. We're sort of doing a second part because I had to empty my card.
So so we're picking up with so you were saying that you would all know each other so well, this group of fellow comedians, you, Jerry, Paul, Jimmy Brogan, and others, as people, that you could kind of really help each other well as comics because you kind of were – you each knew how your brains were working.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, which is wonderful. It's just – that's not something we did every single day, but you could do that when you're watching a friend.
Yeah.
Well, the way Reiser said, hey, take a look at this bit. See if, you know, anything comes into your head.
Hmm.
Well, it's a great way to do it.
Hmm.
On the first times you do the – start doing the Tonight Show or the David Letterman Show, and I would always go down – and still do, to the Comedy and Magic Club in Hermosa Beach here. And if you're there and some friends are in the green room, even not even great friends, but if people you know who are good comics, and I'll still always say, hey, do me a favor, watch this set. It's a five-minute set you're going to do to practice the stand-up you're going to do on the show. And they'll always watch. And you know what? You never know. You just might get a good idea that, oh, that's right, because it closes that up and I can bring that here to there.
Or maybe you're rushing, or maybe you're not taking a pause. I remember seeing Jerry say one time, and people don't understand how hard stand-up is in the sense of sort of it's incremental gains. It's literally millimeters by like. And Jerry said, I have a joke. I can't remember what the joke was. He goes, but for some reason, when I hit the punch, it requires me to turn my head. If I turn my head to the left and up, it doesn't do as well as if I turn my head to the right and up. And he goes, I don't know why.
Right.
I can't figure it out, but there's just certain quirks about certain jokes in this thing that we do.
Yes, exactly right. And it's a wonderful form. Just to let folks know, there's really something very magical and very loving about stand-up comedy.
Mm.
It's deeper than I think we look at it sometimes.
In what way?
Well, for instance, sometimes comics are used to hearing, you know, as part of an introduction, or you're doing it in a corporate job, whatever it is, or in the description in the pamphlet beforehand. And then on the lighter side, we have Larry Miller come in, and every time I heard that phrase, it used to make me smile and shake my head. It's not the lighter side. If you're following an economist from Washington, that's the lighter side.
Right.
But they don't know it. They think that's the heavy side.
Right.
But your look at life is not the lighter side. It's – if it's good, it's a wiser side.
Mm.
And
honest.
Yes.
Yeah.
If it reflects your soul and your mind, and that's what can make people in the audience say, gee, how do you like that? I think I agree with that. Or, gee, I've done that too. Or these are very deep connections.
Yeah. And, you know, you've said something – I think respecting the audience is really important. And I think there are comics now sometimes that sort of think it's kind of cool, like, to, you know, crap on an audience or sort of have disdain for the audience. I think if you pander, it becomes a problem, too, and the audience senses that. But you said something that really resonated with me in an interview that I watched that you did, where you said the audience – and I think you quoted Lenny Bruce. Essentially, the audience individually may not be smart, but collectively – they're very smart and they're very astute. And I feel the same way. Emotionally, they have a very high IQ, and they know if you're BSing you from minute one.
Oh, second one.
If you're
one.
BSing them, I'm sorry, from minute one.
Second one.
Yes.
The second, as you're still walking to the mic, you're communicating from deep inside.
Did you learn that the hard way as a performer? Did you, like, kind of figure that out as you went?
You learn all sorts of things you need as a performer.
Mm.
But I suppose I did learn that along the way of, you know what? Just tell the truth. Go out and say, and I always do that before I go on stage. Standing backstage and it's dark there, I take three deep breaths in through the nose, out through the mouth, and then just look up and say, thank you.
Mm.
You know what? Because I believe that and I feel it.
Mm.
It's a great thing to be doing. It's a very lucky thing. It's a great blessed thing to have in your life. And people, remember, I've had more – the second HBO special I did, I called Just Words.
Mm.
And I picked that because one night – and I used to get this variations of this a lot. Someone came up to me. I was on the road and someone came up to me after a show and he was there with his girlfriend. And he just said – very nice compliment. He just said, you know, boy, you just – you really I loved what you did. You made me laugh and you came out and you just did this and you did that. I said, thank you very much. But and he looked like he wanted to say something. And then he said, no, but I mean, it was just words.
Wow.
And I looked at him. I said, you know what? You're exactly right. And that's a good phrase. I'm going to remember that.
Yeah.
That's it. It's kind of amazing that it's just words. Mm. Obviously, there's a lot of physical humor that can be used. And and it's, whoa, what a wonderful addition that is. But how wonderful, yeah. folks, that just words. Mm. And I mean, you can go out when you see if you're in Carnegie Hall. And you go, you're seated and you're getting in there and you see there's just a chair. The whole stage is empty where they sometimes they have a huge Philharmonic orchestra and or ballet people dancing around in groups of 30. Mm. And the whole thing is empty and with just partitions, you know, going back along the wall there, empty. And in the middle of the stage near the front is just a chair. Like a junior high school science teacher chair. Mm. Mm. And on the chair is a microphone with the cord draping off it and going off stage. Mm. And I and my friends used to say, we went to see some of the greatest folks there, and I and my friends used to notice it instantly and just say, see, that's it. That's what it's all about. It's just words.
Yeah.
That's the setup you need. Do you need anything else? No. Yeah. You need... Yeah. The guy.
You need the guy.
You need the guy to be good.
Yeah.
And ready.
Yes. But it's also somebody that's willing to access difficult places, dark places. It's more than just words, obviously, in the sense of, you know, if you're doing it right, you're making a connection with people because, as you say, you're being honest. And in being honest, I think inherent in that is bravery as a performer.
Sure. Yes. But when I say just words, I mean the vehicle to get them out is just words.
Yeah. But it's
that's
a
what makes it
vehicle.
So wonderful.
Yeah.
And there's if you write a love song, someone with a guitar can write a love song today. Now, have there been many love songs written in the past? Just a few. And isn't it really the message has gotten across already? Yeah, it has. So there's really nothing new to say about love, is there? No, there isn't. But if that fella is a great performer and if he or she writes a fabulous love song that day, then it's like the first love song ever written.
Right.
And will always be that way. That's why you can still listen to not only old songs you used to love, but if a new song comes out and it has the spark in it of magic, of the performer and the writer and the musician.
Right.
Well, then it's the greatest love song ever.
Right.
So in a sense, that's why just words is, I think, such a perfect phrase.
Yeah.
There's nothing else. Well, there's everything else. There's the guy's soul again and his mind and the way he thinks of life and the gift he's been given.
Yeah.
But in a way, it is. It's just words. In a way, it's back to telling stories around a campfire,
right?
Which is a wonderful fabric. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful to do it that way.
It goes back to Will Rogers, right? I mean, it sort of goes way back.
And, of course. Yeah,
and the idea that jokes are a vehicle to give you a window into what that person feels and thinks. You know, the jokes are important, and the structure of the jokes are important. But if they're done right, it's really giving you as a window into that person's soul and mind, I think.
Yes, I do too. On the other hand, by the way, just as another example, I mentioned Milton Berle before. I was working in Las Vegas once. This is really great. It was my first time in Las Vegas, and I was opening for Frank Sinatra.
What?
Which is another story next time on the show. But it was great, and my agent at the time, Tom, was there with me. I didn't have any kind of entourage, and that's fine. Mm. I rented a tux, and that was great. Mm. But one of those nights that I was off, that there was no show, there was a show called The Three Kings of Comedy. And it was Danny Thomas, Sid Caesar, and Milton Berle.
Wow.
It's a pretty good show.
Yeah, I think so.
It's a heck of a show.
Yeah.
And it was at this hotel room in the theater there. We went in. They were all fantastic. I mean, Danny Thomas went up, and what a great storyteller, and he had a great bond with the room. Sid Caesar went up. What a funny man. Again, just does really makes a connection.
Voices, characters, all that stuff. Yeah.
But I'm here to tell you, Milton Berle came up to close the show, and they were all doing 45 minutes each. And Berle started with jokes. I was going to say just jokes, like just words. Mm. But he started with jokes, and they weren't long either. They were 10 to 20 seconds.
He tend to have that kind of hit, yeah, that kind of quick rhythm. Yeah.
Exactly.
Not quite Henny Youngman, but sort of in that world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was, to say the least, what a powerful performer. Mm. What a way. He knows how to – I was at all the devices coming up from vaudeville to really make that connection.
Right.
Folks, I'm telling you, I thought, wow, I don't know if I have anything left in me. And he comes up, and I loved the guy. And he comes up and starts doing his act. Boom, boom, boom. Folks, he got that room and me so quickly. I'm telling you, within about 8 minutes or 12 minutes, whatever the heck it was, I was howling.
Really?
And, I mean...
Just took it to another level?
He was that good, and he came through the material that well.
What was it that sort of allowed him... was it his technique, his rhythm? Because his punches were so compact and tight and close together that he wouldn't give the audience a minute to breathe? What was it?
All of those things, but remember something. This is a guy who had... practiced a lot.
Yeah.
He's been since roughly 1930 or 28.
And not just a lot, but I think doing a lot of different kinds of performing informs all the other performing. I think you're a great actor because you're a great stand-up. I think you're a great stand-up because you're a great actor. You know, and those guys in those days, they did it all. They did a little song, a little dance, they did big halls, small halls, all of that.
That's right. They could lean back and kind of, you know, start swaying and sing a song. You've never heard a better song.
Mm.
But Berle didn't do that, and I'm telling you, it was shattering.
Wow.
That I looked over at Tom. We were howling.
Really?
And the room was screaming. And he just kept it a boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, after 45 minutes, the clothes were sweated through. I mean, there was no such thing as, hey, let's get another drink, stick your finger up, and we'll get another drink.
Right.
There was nothing to do but sit there and let him just wash this wave over you.
Mm.
And then when you finished, folks, to stand up and feel a little dizzy.
Wow.
Because not only have you just seen, for goodness sake, Danny Thomas and Sid Caesar, who were great.
Yeah.
But then to put that cherry on top of Berle.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
And he was, I'm telling you, he was the captain of the ship.
As a comic yourself, just in terms of, did you take anything away from that in terms of as a performer that you thought, okay, I should do something like that? Not do his act, but like just anything that happened that night that you think sort of affected you as a performer in any way?
The greatest lesson I could learn and did learn from him that night was just howl and love it.
Yeah.
You know what? Sometimes you don't have to analyze it or think, wow, how many words were in that setup?
Yeah.
But just to know that's possible.
Mm.
It's not only possible, it's doable. It's not only doable, you just saw it.
Yeah.
And
amazing.
That's pretty amazing right there. So was there any lesson to it? That was the lesson.
Cool.
That this guy could do that. And then afterwards, the next time you see him, I saw him that night, I think, and just, you know, sit in the coffee shop and with him and his wife.
Mm.
But just to say that, he was, God bless him, he was already, for crying out loud,
he's
already 88.
Yeah. How was he off? Was he sort of a little more mellow off stage, or was he on as well, or was he kind of more?
Neither.
Like,
he was just such a powerful presence.
Really?
And with a smile, and God bless him, he loved being his wife was just wonderful, Ruth, and she passed on a couple of years later. But he liked being with me, and I sure liked being with him.
That's great that you got to be able to have that experience. Yeah,
tell you about Spencer Tracy.
Yeah.
He would tell you
about Spencer. Yeah.
All these things about show business.
Right.
And how he started in this and whatever it was. Mm. How the waiter, you know, oh, look at that couple over there. She's younger than him or something. But I mean, funny.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
saying things, you go, holy mackerel, yeah. he's funny.
Yeah. It's a legend. You know, it's like one of the faces on Mount Rushmore of comedy. I mean, that's
a good image for it. Boy, the Mount Rushmore of comedy.
Mm. Hmm. I want to just ask you quickly. I don't, before we wrap up. I mean, how are you feeling? I know you fell down. You hit your head. You were in a coma for 2 weeks. You had a brain injury.
Yes.
Boy, you'll do anything to take a rest. I'll tell you. and you seem great. But how are you feeling? And what I've never read exactly what caused you to pass out. You tripped or you misstepped off a curb or something, or what happened?
Okay, I walked out of a small building. Okay, it was a bar. And I don't know if I'd mentioned that. But you know what? The truth is, sometimes you really are touched and, you know, you could die from something like this. I cracked my head like a walnut. Mm. I wasn't, you know, drunk. I wasn't sober. But, I mean, did I let someone go by? It doesn't matter. You slip them.
Whatever, and you fall, and you hit your head right on the curb, right around the corner of the curb or something.
Yeah, on the wall. It doesn't matter at that point.
Yeah.
The answer is, yeah, you hit your head. Mm. And I went back inside, and this was a tough bar too, out here in L.A. And I had been there, and the point is, it wasn't late now. It was about 8:30 or something like that, and I walked in. And I mean, these are tough guys. The bartenders there can handle anyone.
Yeah.
And I liked them, and I brought a book with me, and I would sit in the corner and have a martini. And it wasn't a martini-type bar, but they'd always make me one. And
yeah.
And I ordered the roast chicken dinner, which was half a roast chicken. It wasn't out yet. And I said, you know what, I sat back down. I said, you know what, I think I'll still take that chicken. But this guy, Patty... spelled P-A-D-D-Y.
Yeah.
And he looked over at me and actually jerked back physically and said, Jesus, Larry, what did you do to yourself? And this guy's
he's probably seen
everything.
Seen a few things.
This guy could.
He's trunks of cars, things have happened,
oh,
yes.
Oh, please. He could put a beer keg down you.
He's the guy that John, the owner of the comic strip, would call to take you to Jersey to take care of you.
Yeah. And at any rate, though, he said...
Are you bleeding?
Yeah.
But you don't know you're bleeding.
No, but I cracked myself pretty good. Mm. It was all head, and head wounds bleed a lot. Mm. And he said, Larry, look, I'm gonna call an ambulance for you. He poured me a club soda. He said, Just sip on this and sit there. Don't move. And he called Nami. Isn't this funny? This place is so tough. They had two ambulances around the corner.
just in case.
Always. And that's how they know where the cab's going to go. The airport.
Yeah.
You're going to get in line at the airport because that's where people are going to need a cab.
Right.
So where are the ambulances going to go? This place. Because that's where every so often.
Around 1 a.m, somebody's going to need an ambulance.
Someone cracks his head like a walnut. So I got in there. It was very, thank God, I was very lucky. They put you in a coma the day after I got there.
Oh, they did. Why?
That's what they do.
Is that the swelling? You have swelling on the brain?
That's how they do it. They put you in a coma and then operate to take your skull off the top of the skull so that the brain can heal and grow a little. Mm. Excuse me. And so... thank God I made it.
Do you dream in a coma? Do you remember anything from the coma?
No, nothing. And
do you come up with any good material while you're in the coma?
Sure. I'm a comic. But you know what? I was just remembering that because you can die.
Mm.
And I did. Speaking of things you remember.
When you're induced into a coma, you
No, I in particular. People die from this wound.
Oh.
And I was one of them. And I went up and didn't, you know, say hi to my parents or anything. Just went right to the big office.
Would you see a light, or did they say you see a light or anything?
No.
Or?
And God came in and was very angry. because he thought what I did was stupid. And he told me why, what I was supposed to be doing in life and what I was made for. And but I was a little shaking because I don't think you want to see him angry.
No. What did he tell? What did he tell you should be doing? Exactly what you were doing before.
Asking forgiveness, and then just he said, you know, do you want to? If you want to go back, I never send anyone back. But if you go back, you better do all this stuff better.
Wow.
And because then if you come back again without having done it. Well, it won't.
You're not going to like it.
It won't be a good day then.
You're going to wish you were going to New Jersey with Patty.
That's right. That's exactly right. But that wouldn't have mattered either because you still would have wound up back in the office.
That's true.
So it doesn't matter how.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how or when.
Has it changed your perspective in terms of the way you do your comedy, what you talk about in your comedy now? Or?
You know what? There's so many answers to that. Yes and no.
Mm.
But I mean, you know, now after you and I part, after we finish the show, I'm going to pick up one of my kids at school after baseball practice, and I'll take him home, make some dinner, and then tonight, for an hour or two, I'm going to write some, take things apart, and see how it goes.
Yeah, great.
And how's it going to go? I'll tell you the next time.
All right, great.
But you just never stop. Maybe that was the lesson from Burrow. You never stop.
Mm.
You start punching, and you keep going, and people are howling
because
you're that good and your stuff is that good, and you've really stitched it together.
Yeah. Well, this has been true. I said this at the beginning. Someone that I've always looked up to and admired and just thought you were brilliant. Five Levels of Drinking is a piece that you have to see along with all of also an author.
That's right. Book. I have a book out called Spoiled Rotten America.
Yes, and people should pick that up on Amazon. And I'm sure you're going to be in a plethora of movies.
There's another movie coming
out.
Yeah, speaking of being at Adam Carolla's here now, that I'm in a movie of his called Road Hard.
Right. You play his agent.
His manager.
His manager, sorry.
And I loved doing that. Yeah. I love acting.
Yeah.
And I love
so good
writing. And I'm a comic. I'll never leave that or stop it.
Well, I would like to have you on again and we'll talk some more because there's lots of other things I want to talk to you about and just the stories of the comic strip in New York and all of that. So
good.
I'd love to have you on again. It's been an honor to have you on. This is Larry Miller, brilliant stand-up comedian, brilliant actor, author, father, and a completely horrible bartender. Thank you for doing the show.
Not in the house. You'd like me in my house.
In the house, you're good.
Pretty good.
If you want a Budweiser, he's your man.
Or if you say, I'd like some whiskey.
Okay.
I can do that.
You can do that. Some Murphy's. Boom. Two bottles right on the table.
Yeah.
Thanks again for doing this. This has been great.
Pal, same here.
All right. So that was Larry Miller. How great a storyteller is he? And how hilarious is that he doesn't know how to bartend and he's just giving beers away for free? Thanks for checking it out. Please spread the word about the podcast. Tell your friends about it. Send the link around. We want to keep building this. Ask them to subscribe. It's a free subscription. You get a new podcast every Monday on iTunes, through iTunes. And my tour dates are on my website, paulmercurio.com. May 1st and 2nd, I'm going to be at the Comedy Connection in Providence, Rhode Island. May 7th through the 10th, I'm going to be at the Funny Bone in Cincinnati, Ohio. May 15th and 16th in Long Island at the Brokerage Comedy Club in Belmore. And most importantly, follow me on Facebook and Twitter. We want to keep blowing that up too. At Paul Mercurio. And you guys are the best. Thanks for checking it out and tell your friends about the podcast. This is a special one this week. I'm glad you guys got to hear it. I hope you enjoyed it.